done. Let's talk about these. Where do you want to go? Somebody, out loud. Let's get like a sense of the body. Where do you want to go? What do you want to talk about? Good. Go ahead, louder. Out loud. Just yell. The plan debate narrative. What else? Perms. What else? Counter plan.
A resolution.
Okay. We'll start with narrative. Narrative? Is that cool? You want to start with narrative? What's your question? Who has a specific question on narrative so we can start it? Yes, sir. Yeah. You can't run a narrative on the affirmative, for example, unless you stand up and do the following things. Your first observation has to be that storytelling is important. Right, and that for some reason storytelling or anecdote as proof is a more reliable way to test the resolution than using the testimony of experts in international relations. The second observation you have to run for it to make any sense is you have to give the judge a way to decide who tells the better story. You have to give criteria that the judge can use to decide which story is better, because one of the options the negative will have will be to counter-story your story. Right, they'll tell a story too. And the judge has to have criteria. If the judge has no criteria to decide which story is better than another story, then the affirmative is in big trouble. Because the first arguments you run against narratives are the following. The first argument you do is you argue stories are illegitimate. A lot of good literature on this, that anecdotes can't serve as proof. They tend to be atypical. A lot of evidence that says that the stories are not being told in the first person. Right, what ends up happening is the debater is telling someone else's story. And when you tell someone else's story, you don't really give them a voice. The third argument we use, which we always get distance and legs with, is it exploits the story. You know, if the affirmative wants to run this, then they're willing to give up the ballot and the debate, we'll do it. We'll go through this. The negative will win, and we'll talk about the story. But as soon as you take someone's personal story and you try to win a ballot with it, you really suck. And you're exploiting this person. That's our third argument. On the second argument, where we argue you have to decide which story is better than another story, if they don't give criteria, we critique them. We argue that their story will by default be evaluated against our story by using white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant theory on what makes a good story. And also, it's incredibly fellow-centric. Right? We say, that's the critique. Now, if they're smart, and they have come up with another criteria which tends to avoid these, then we have to debate out the criteria they're presenting. Right, on how to evaluate one story to another. For example, the default criteria for evaluating story against story are things like the stuff that Walter Fisher at the other USC did when he was writing about narrative, and he talks about narrative probability and narrative fidelity, and these things, are just default to the present system, or default to trends. So what you end up having is like a white male perspective on what constitutes a good story. I mean, there's a reason so many women writers wrote under male pen names, right? We know this, and that's what that's based on. It's not really, the other strategy you can use is a weird strategy, is to ask, cross X is critical in narrative debate. Because you could win a narrative debate if you could ask questions about the narrative that the speaker can't answer. Right? There's a real problem when someone's telling a story and you go, what happened to the kitty cat? And they go, what kitty cat? And you go, the one you were talking about up top. They go, I don't know. What kind of story is that? Might as well all go see the 13th floor. I don't know if you've seen that. I was so damn perplexed. And I'm pretty smart. What the hell? You've got to tell me what happens to these characters. They just can't disappear. But those are the strategies you would use, I think, against the narrative. Those are the formative ones. It's the critiques against the narrative that really win the debate. You can really win the debate. And if you're really good, you can counter-critique. You can really counter-critique. It's tough. I mean, it depends on the story. It really depends on the story. But, if you're a white male, if you debate any stories you're going to be able to tell in these debate rounds, they're going to work very well in response to a narrative. It's just not there. Because usually the narratives that need voices are usually the narratives of the minority. Of women oppressed groups and ethnic groups. And if you're not in those, it's kind of tough to really do it. What's next? Yes?
What's the ask structure for an ironic proof and what's the negative against it?
there's a real tough to do an ironic proof because you gotta start the debate outside of the debate. It's hard to, you gotta go. You've got to really argue almost an observation that irony is the best way to understand things. Then you've got to present your ironic proof. Because the good answer to irony is, unless the other team notices, it doesn't work. Which is how we beat it. We act really dumb. Right? You get the irony debate, and then you get in one end, and you go, wow, I wonder what the hell they're doing. I don't have any idea what they're doing. You know, most people we debate just sort of talk about, you know, what they're doing on the affirmative. I think they're going negative. That's us. You vote for us. Don't vote for them. They're going negative. Thank you. Now, irony won't happen unless there's an audience. That's how irony works. You've got to have an audience for irony to work. And if you refuse to be the audience, there ain't no irony. It doesn't happen. And if you do that as a strategy, we've discovered most of the time the second affirmative will go up there and go, you don't understand, we're being ironic. And you're like, what? Are we supposed to take you seriously? Right? Because you don't know. You don't know what's going on at that point, right? You don't know, are they being ironic? Are they not being ironic? And it's really fun that you and I are, because you go, all right, I don't know how this irony thing works, but I think if you're the judge and you want to be ironic, you vote for us. Yeah, you got to have a lot of fun in irony debates. You really do. If you take them too seriously, you feed them. You really do. You end up feeding their arguments if you start looking at it really, really truthfully. The other thing you can do, which is an incredible amount of fun, is go for it. If they want to be ironic, you be ironic. What a mess. It is the most confusing experience you will ever have, because there's clash, but the clash is absolutely reversed. The affirmative's negative, the negative's affirmative, but you know what? I'll tell you, there's nothing like being affirmative when you're negative and having the negative block. So if you want to debate up irony straight up, you've got 15 minutes of damage. Just think how much fun it would have if you had a 15-minute affirmative speech. Right, and that's what happens when you're negative in an irony debate. So I'm not sure the strategy is that sensible. I think there might be some real problems with it. But it's fascinating. It's just incredibly fascinating. The literature in irony is incredibly fascinating. And I'm writing the new book, and there's a section of a chapter on irony that I'm putting into the book. And it was the most entertaining of all the reading I had to do. Probably gives you another reference point of what the rest of that stuff looks like. Reading about counterfactuals really hurt me. Yeah. What do you want to know about plan?
All right. Here's what I'm curious about.
Yeah.
The two standards you had were look at the better resolutional proof and look at the argument. Now, if we look at the better resolutional proof, why can't I argue that the negative proving in the resolution is a vote for me?
Well, because you want to hear the wank reason? The wank reason is because at the bottom of the ballot it says the better debating was done by, it doesn't really matter. I mean, at the negative are just like affiliations we've just arbitrarily established in the debate now. You'll lose that argument. I mean, if they're smart, you'll lose that argument. You're not going to win that argument. And I think what you have to argue, you can't just get up there and go, they're going affirmative. Because they'll go, yeah, right. Correct. The reason we're going affirmative is the only way to debate you is to go affirmative. Because if we go negative, the way to debate you would be running counterplans. And they claim that counterplans are really illegitimate because you can't establish competition. That the best way to decide who actually wins the debate is to look at who does the better interpretation of the topic. And that's often, like, the first theory is done definitionally, right? It's like, who better encapsulates the concepts in the resolution because of the plan they've constructed. The second theory is different. The second theory says you really decide which has the better proof based upon the quality of the evidence that's being read and strength of the link stories, which is a little different. The other thing you do in a plan debate is you can run disadvantages against their plan. So on the first day, they're in a plan debate. What ends up happening, if you're smart and you're running, I would never have my kids run plan. I think there's too many ways to hurt yourself. That what ends up happening is we'd run disadvantages against the affirmative plan, then you'd run your plan, which of course is impervious to the disadvantages you ran. Then the second affirmative runs disadvantages to your plan, and then answers the disadvantages to their plan. and then extends the voting issue through. Inevitably, I've watched these debates happen, it's the cross-linkage. It's hard to run disadvantages against someone's affirmative that doesn't link a bit to yours. That's so tough to do, and you really hurt yourself when you do it. And obviously, critiques disappear. They become non, you can't really critique in a Pelham plan debate. So that's all gone. And you can't argue topicality, but it's really weird. Because you can argue the affirmative interpretation of the resolution is not topical, but our interpretation of the resolution is topical. And so you're voting against the affirmative because they're not topical and voting for the negative because they are topical. But the problem you have when you do that is, again, the cross-linkage in the debate is bizarre because a tiny slip-up can screw you. And I think that's the problem with Plan Plan. I think it's an interesting idea. I just think when you try to execute it, you can't make a... I mean, let's face it, we all screw up. You know, you mess up in debate rounds, and it's great to like mess up and be able to still pull it out. Oh man, Plan doesn't give you many opportunities to pull it out. You're just stuck. And you do it to yourself, and that's incredibly embarrassing, I think. I think that's the reason. I think it's the reason it sort of came and writ really quickly. But, you know, I bet you if, you know, Mahoney's judging you, someone might try it. And if I'm judging you and someone wants to go for it, they'll probably try it. There's about a handful of people who actually listen to them. You know, but they're hard to win. They're incredibly difficult to win. Because, I mean, they smell bad. I mean, you know, in a metaphorical way, there's something wrong with them. You know there's something wrong with them because they're affirmative again. You know, I think, and you can argue, I think, a pretty legitimate argument that, you know, this is, if there's any argument that was bad for the debate, this is it. Because you have, just think of it would be like going to terms where you'd only go affirmative. That's all you would do is go affirmative for round after round after. I'm not sure how much you'd learn. I don't know what you'd be teaching if on the negative people were writing their affirmatives. And that's what they did when they ran Plan Plan. They literally went affirmative in all their affirmative rounds and went affirmative in all their negative rounds. I think they were lazy. Yeah, I see a hand way back there.
I think a Plan Plan team would argue they're all going negative every time they fall negative. Because
sure. I mean, I think the implication would be the same thing you find on the bottom of some T arguments on breath, death, defecation, and all that other stuff, which I don't buy, but, you know, whatever. You know, if you're going to argue T, come up with a good reason. The thing is, these are theories. The way you beat theories is by taking them apart, not by arguing they're abusive. I mean, you don't impress your judges when you get up there and whine at us about, oh, this is so abusive, how am I supposed to win? Think. That's a good way. Think. That's how you win. Right? If it's that abusive, you probably can come up with a way of thinking your way out of it without yelling at us that it's abusive. More questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the counter plan?
The counter plan.
Yeah, at that point, like when you say
stop peeping.
Advocacy is a better counter plan or whatever you go, do you then, like, drop
out
of your plan?
Oh, no, you never advocate the counter plan. The counter plan is just treated just like a permutation is. You just say, this is a reason you'd reject the counter plan. Well, you don't advocate anarchy. It would be highly problematic to advocate both the affirmative and anarchy simultaneously. I think this theory really hasn't gone far enough, right? I mean, this theory is relatively new. It's been bantered about on eDebate more than anywhere else. And I think you could probably, I'm not sure I'm willing to say this, but you probably could. You probably could get away with advocating the counter plan, but for what the affirmative does. You have anarchy everywhere but the affirmative, but that would be better than just socialism. It'd be tough. You're first.
I'm just wondering, doesn't that become regressive at some point? I mean, could the negatives continue that trend after the counter plan? Just keep going. I mean, as opportunity costs to the even the competitive set, even if you're not advocating it.
I think you're correct. You would have to put a stop into it. And I think the end stop would be that space that exists between the 2NC and the 1NR. That we have generally accepted that no new arguments would be introduced after that point. So pretty much whatever arguments were introduced into the 2NC is where the progression would end. But logically, you're right, logically it's infinite. I mean, if you took this in its true sense, you could opportunity cost throughout. Like in a seminar, it'd be just a lot of fun, right? You just keep going. Keep going, and you keep going, until you find out where the end is, if there is an end. You're next.
Yeah, I was just wondering,
Okay, I'm completely lost in the counterpoint.
That's okay.
I mean, if you started saying counterplan.
You got to read this stuff. I mean, I force my students to do this, to read this stuff, and it's boring stuff. I know that, but you can't expect us to take incredibly complex theories and speak to you in 5 minutes and it to become really lucid. It's not going to happen. This is a lot of deep thinking that's taking place. I mean, these are a bunch of debate coaches who, by their nature, are pretty twisted, who are spending a time talking to each other and developing new ways of beating the crap out of each other. And I mean, they're bringing their own understanding of some of these complex ideas together, and it's tough. I mean, you've got to read the material. If you want to learn about counterplans, you just go to eDebate, you go to the archive, you type in counterplans and get a list of all the postings and plan. I mean, it took me about a week and a half to read all the postings on counterplans to figure out what the hell this is and where it's going. And that's the way to get a sense of it. They have not been read. I mean, they have not been run a lot. They've been run very seldomly. They work in the ism debates on the negative. When you have somebody stand up and they run socialism, or someone stands up and they run anarchism, or someone stands up and they run, oh, I don't know, you know, some radical feminism position, or like Aaron and Carolina used to keep running your radical lesbianism position, right? When you run things like that, you tend to win the debate because of extra competitive advantages. You're just bigger than the affirmative. And the way to get out of that is to argue those advantages are extra competitive and they're illegitimate. Well, this takes it a step further and gives a reason why they're illegitimate. The reason they're illegitimate is because they carry opportunity costs with them that compete with other ideas that might be more beneficial. I think what's happening in debate is we're moving away from the abuse argument, if you notice. I mean, over the last half decade, the abuse argument is dying. People are now coming up with reasons why you reject the theory rather than just claiming it as a violation. I think that's one of the reasons also why topicality isn't winning as many debates as it used to. It's because people aren't willing to pull the trigger on an argument that says, I'm being abused. Because that's an incredible avenue for the judge to enter into the debate, and judges don't want to do that. Yeah, we have one more after you.
Would that be one, you mentioned that the counter-counterplan is a good way to
No, not necessarily. If I'm getting threat, okay, let me give you an example. If I'm running my affirmative on Helms Burton, and the negative stands up and claims that the affirmative is void because it's premised on conceptions of threat, and they run the threat perception literature, I can stand up in second affirmative and say, and counter critique the threat perception, that that threat perception is a void theoretical construct because it's incredibly naive, which is where generally the best arguments against threat construct is that this is incredibly naive. This is a bunch of doves who are just speculating that threats never exist, and that is incredibly dangerous because there are threats out there. And that's a counter-critique. A counter-counter-plan is where you actually advocate a plan. You advocate a, you suggest a plan which is your counter-counter-plan which competes with the counter-plan that the negative ran. You don't do that in a critique debate. In a counter-critique debate, all you do is say, your critique is wrong. In the counter-counter-plan debate, you're saying, your counter-plan competes with a better idea. Now, if the one end turns their critique into a counter-plan, like, envision, if you will, a world without threat perception. In the creation of all possible worlds out there, I will create a possible world which doesn't have threat perception in it. That's my counterplan. It's called a counterfactual. It's called a counterfactual thought experiment. And I turn that as my counterplan. Then when you run your counterplan, you might say that this possible world that Berube just talked about competes with another possible world that's better, which means you have to reject his possible world. Tetlock, T-E-T-L-O-C-K, Tetlock. Write this down. Tetlock. T-E-T-L-O-C-K. Belkin, B-E-L-K-I-N, co-edited a book called Counterfactual Thought Experiments in World Politics. You probably want to look at it. I think, my concluding remarks, I think you could run an affirmative on this resolution where you did a counterfactual thought experiment and you literally went back in time. I think you could do this. I think you could argue that but for certain actions and reactions associated with the Shah, we would not have the problem we have in Iran today. I think you could say, but for certain reactions and actions that occurred around the Cuban Missile Crisis, we would not have the problems we have in Cuba today. And you could probably do one for each of the countries if you paid close attention to things. And guess what? People in international relations have already done this. And I've read an Iran one, and I've read three or four Cuban Missile Crisis ones, at least. I mean, so that's an area of the topic which is incredibly fun. Because we haven't had counterfactual affirmatives in about 4 or 5 years, so it'd be kind of fun to bring them up again. Because that way you get the debate in the past, which is kind of cool. And they could read all these cards from the president and go, 1990, what? I don't understand. You're decades away from us. How do you get this information? Here's the deal. Finish your lab, do a good job, get it all done, clean up the mess, bring the books back to the library. Don't get up yet. You're lucky you're not in some of my classes at Carolina. I throw things. I'm standing. Make sure you get all your paper. If you want to talk to folks who wrote the stuff that's on the paper, they're here from 1 to 3. Check the schedule outside. If you plan to do anything else but debate at the practice rounds that are at the end of the institute, which of course is your choice, you need to talk to myself or talk to Shannon. The instruction is over.